As we continue in 1 Corinthians, I hope that you'll keep in mind the reality that the Lord has made us different from the world. So that is the reality. But oftentimes our lives don't reflect the reality. And if I had to sum up the message of 1 Corinthians in two words, be what? Different is the word that I've decided to do when I preach this book. I'm still going through my series of preaching through each New Testament book, or each book of the Bible, one sermon for each book. And after some reflection on what this book is actually saying, it dawned on me that what Paul's actually telling these people is, your life is not looking different from the other people there at Corinth, but it should. You should be different. You should be different from the others. And I'm encouraged to see testimonies like this and others where you're catching the idea that the Lord is changing you. We just had testimonies in our chapel here for the School of Theology. And it was encouraging to hear each of these students who are going to graduate, each of them talk about how they are different now than when they came in. But I hope as we go along, you'll be asking yourself, you know, how am I? How am I different? How am I becoming different? Do you think that you're changing? Sometimes we can get the idea that we really are not changing. But the reality is, every one of us is changing every day. But the question is, which way are we changing? Are we changing to be more like Christ, or are we changing to be less like Christ? Are we drawing closer to Him, or are we falling away from Him? And these steps are so incremental. These are so small, we normally don't discern them. But you're not the same person that you were a year ago. You have changed. And I pray that the way you've changed is that you're different in the positive way. That's what Paul's actually talking about in the book. We have this herd mentality. You know, we just kind of do whatever everybody else does. This was emphasized by our Korean speaker in our chapel today. We showed all the Koreans dressed alike. They all look alike. You know, there's a very much, it's not just an issue in Korea. It's very much something that we follow. So if the society as a whole is going downward, guess what? We're going to go downward with them. And I find it astonishing that things that are proposed in my own country now would never have been thought about. No one would ever have considered 2 years ago. For example, it was just decided that all the airlines in the United States need to comply with when people register for flights to have a third sex. Right now it's male or female. But all the airlines are now forced to, I don't know what they're going to call the third sex. I think it's X. And for your title, are you Mr.? Are you Ms.? If you're not sure, you just tick the third box, MX. This is a new sex that was invented this week in America. MX means... it means mixed. They didn't put the word up after it. It doesn't mean mixed up. It means mixed. So this is for people who have mixed gender. Right? That was unheard of even 2 weeks ago or a year ago. I remember when I went into Nepal, one of my trips to Nepal, there was this, you know, you have to go fill out the little form. And it said, male, female. What was the third one? I think it was other. And I thought, that's so interesting. So then we got to the screening area. And the ladies' line it went back at least 200 women. I mean, that's like an hour long to get in that line, you know? And then I looked at the men's line. Men's line, look, there's about 150 men waiting in line. And then up at the front, of course, you have to walk through the little screening thing. There was no third line. And I thought, well, the form just said, are you male? Are you female? Are you other? So I thought, hey, I think I'll be other, you know? So you tick the box. Instead of waiting in that long ladies' line, that long men's line, you go right on up to the counter. Hi, excuse me, where's the other line? Let me just screen through, you know. That's what I thought about doing, but I really wanted to do it, but then I thought they might find out why I actually came there to teach the Bible or something like that. And I could tell them, well, the Bible has, you know, and he created them male and female, you know, and it may not work so well.
But the Mr. X, MX, right?
Yeah.
Is it an aviation law or is it like a state, in terms of the legal system?
Well, it's something that all the airlines have agreed to. And Facebook kept adding sexes. They got up to 57. But now it's above 100. It's what, 200 or something like that here. And I don't know if they scaled it back or not. But there's transitioning from this into that and all that. I heard the story this morning in the U.S. in... This person was going through the prison system. They were trying to, they had to frisk, you know, they had to check the person who was started as Jeremy when he was in the army, but now he says he's Jessica. Did you hear the same one? Jessica, yeah. And so he took to court the prison because he says, you guys have stopped my hormone therapy. The prison doctors have prevented this. They said, well, we don't do this kind of thing in prison. This is an all-male, this is an all-men prison. So we don't have anybody transitioning into female, you know. So the prisoner took the prison system to court, and he just won the case.
Oh,
and he won, was it $130,000, I think? So they transition. Where do you put a person like that? You got the men's prison and the women's prison. What are the prison officials supposed to do? So they transition him out, and of course they had to bring him into some other prison. But how do you frisk the person? So they decided, okay, we'll have a female correction officer frisk the top, and a male correction officer frisk the bottom. You know, or maybe it was the other way around. This is all getting so complex. But we have this herd mentality that we are all supposed to be on board with all this. And how do we go different from that? When everybody else is going that way. Well, this was where the Corinthians were at. Because the whole society was moving, I call it the crossroads of immorality. The whole society was moving toward immorality. And if you want to live a pure life, you're just going against it all. Corinth was located on the small neck, or right near the neck of the Corinthian Peninsula. It's still called the Corinthian Peninsula, I believe, today, in the southern part of Greece. Ships, up to the time of, near the time of when Paul wrote the letter, they would go from the Adriatic Sea or somewhere in the west from Rome, etc. They would come and they would sail around the Corinthian Peninsula, let's say if they're going up to Thessalonica or somewhere up in the Aegean Sea. All right. This was a long trip. It was a hazardous trip going among these various islands to south of the Corinthian Peninsula. All right. So some ingenious business people decided to start a business where you could park your ship on one side. They would put it on rollers and roll it 7 kilometers over to the other side of the isthmus. This took only like 2 days, but all the sailors would leave and they would go to nearby Corinth and then they'd meet the ship over on the other side. And this, you know, 2 day of, you can see if you go to Corinth today, where they actually rolled the ships up, they put them on logs. They had these specialized crews that would do that. Well, that gave the sailors, you know, 2 or 3 days, and it's only an hour walk over to Corinth or take a horse over there or whatever. So they had a few free days of liberty, is what we call it, right? That's what we call it in the U.S. Armed Forces when you have a few days off. It's called liberty. What is liberty for? Liberty is freedom. Freedom to do whatever you want to do. You know, the interesting thing is, oftentimes when we're given liberty, we end up in bondage because of our liberty. And that's what was happening here. At the backside, or the south side of Corinth, was called Acrocorinth. Acro means hill, you know, up above. And at Acrocorinth was the temple of Aphrodite. That's the background. The goddess of love up on the hill with 1,000 prostitutes there. And this is the church that Paul founded. And they, like all churches, they had come from the unbelieving lifestyle. And they thought like the unbelievers. Have you noticed this? As you interact with people from different cultures, that the Christians have they have the same characteristics of the non-Christians that they come out of. You want me to get specific? You want me to get specific? Americans are very individualistic. So I find American Christians, there's a process where they have to get out of that American individualism and learn community. People know they want to do that. American society is materialistic. And so people have to learn, American Christians have to learn that life, there's more to life than just things and money. I think many of you Singaporeans can relate to us Americans in that regard. Both in the area of individualism and materialism. These are characteristics that happen with urbanization, actually. When you have urban societies, people move faster and the family unit is broken up. This was addressed last night as well. One of our reasons for depression is our lack of community. And urban societies break up families. You get fathers, mothers, both working. You get children going all every different direction. And so we end up being like those that... Well, we don't end up being like the world. We start like the world. And we come to know Christ, and it's a process of learning not to be like the society that we came from. We tend to think of, he's like the world. No, that's where he started. And this is actually the process of sanctification that we see. So I call the book of 1 Corinthians, the message of it is be different. Don't be like everybody else. If you look like you're everybody else, then you're not really seeing who you are in Christ. We'll see a similar thing when we get to 1 Peter later on in the New Testament. Peter writes to these people who are all in their home areas, and he says that you are aliens and strangers. Now, that would make sense to me if I got a letter from Paul and he called me an alien or a stranger. Because I'm an American living in Singapore. And even after 28 years here, by the way, tomorrow is my anniversary. Wow. 28 years from right now, I was on the plane flying my family to Singapore. And we arrived after midnight. So we actually arrived on the 20th of February, 1991. A tired man and woman, fresh with my doctorate and not knowing what I didn't know. I only knew a few things I knew, but I didn't know how much I didn't know. With a 4-year-old boy and a 1-year-old boy. And we got off the plane, and a few hours later, we had chapel at 10 a.m. I remember getting off the plane at 1 a.m. And of course, you know, we went down the ramp and Changi Airport. There was only one terminal back then. There was only one expressway in Singapore, the PIE back in 91. Can you believe that? Can you think of one? There's only one MRT line, you know, east-west line. It was a very different country. But one thing that was the same is when you get out of the airport and you step into the 1 a.m. weather. And I went, oh, this is so hot. And this is 1 a.m. What is it like when it's 1 p.m.? You know, and I thought, in my mind, I was 33 years old. I said, I'm staying until I'm 65. Am I going to do this 32 years? That was my first thought, you know. But fortunately, we jumped right in the taxi, and it was an air-conditioned taxi. You know? So then I thought, but anyway, what's my point? I don't know. I forgot my point. How should we be different from unbelievers? It's nice to have it right up there. We tend to just be like everybody else, and we come to know Jesus, and then we need to learn that way, like everybody else, is really no fun. Corinthians thought they're having fun with their so-called liberality. And you see Paul mention this quite a few times in the letter. But if they really were learning to be different, they would realize that there's a whole lot of joys in the Christian life by being united, for example. So he tells them the first four chapters, you guys are all divided. I want you to be united. I want you to be of one mind, one goal. I want you to be moral, is how I sum up, try to in a simple way, what Paul's saying in chapters 5 and 6. It is actually reported that there's a man among your congregation who's living with his father's wife, Paul says. This is not even done among the pagans. This is not the Corinthian Christians being like the godless Corinthians. It's being worse than the godless Corinthians. Because the pagans would look at this and go, what? A man has his father's wife. Probably more literally means he married his father's wife. I presume that his father died. And he ends up marrying his father's widow. I don't know. Maybe it was worse than that. But they are also taking one another to court. And he says that in chapter 6. You guys, settle your disputes among yourselves, you know. And then finally, the latter part of the book, I think the message is be selfless. Here's the doctrinal difficulties. Were they doctrinal difficulties? Yeah. They had doctrinal problems relating to marriage, idol worship, the role of women, Lord's Supper, spiritual gifts, resurrection, in order, going from chapter 7 up to 15. But the central idea of their doctrinal problems was they didn't realize that godly, genuine theology gives us a selflessness. And you Corinthians are being selfish in all these doctrinal areas. You know, you can have different options, right, in doctrinal beliefs. If you pick the option that is godless theology, I would all say that the godless theology is also the selfish theology. The godly theology is the selfless theology. In other words, true theology helps us be more concerned about others than ourselves. And these Corinthians, everything they were doing in the church was for themselves. No wonder why they didn't have unity, like he mentions in the first four chapters. No wonder why they had immorality. People get caught up in immorality when they only think about themselves, right? Who gets caught up in immorality because they're thinking of the other person? It's just totally contrary to the whole idea. And so this book is basically telling these people they really need to be different. To sum up the main idea, my other one was a little bit more complicated. This is simpler. Here's, I think, the main idea. This is how I preach it. Be different. by being united, moral and selfless. There's our three sections of the book. Don't be divided. You know, don't divide the church. Be different by being united. Everybody else is in their own little cliques and little groups and stuff, but your church shouldn't be that way. Be moral. A lot of other people are going up to Acrocorinth to so-called worship with the prostitutes up there, to worship the goddess of love, Aphrodite. But no, 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 you be moral. This message is really needed for our day. I mean, you guys are living in the same world I'm living in, right? And people are sharing with you, right? I mean, do you men have men come to you and confess that they've been over with prostitutes? It is so hard for me to hear that. Especially when it's one of my students. Fortunately, this was not a day student. This was an evening student, one of our professionals, who shared with me that this was his... And I said, wow, 1 Corinthians 6. And then lastly, be different by being selfless. Basically, the book. And what does he mean by be different? We saw that the word was sanctified. The second verse of the book. To those who are sanctified in Christ Jesus, that's who this book is written to. In other words, they're set apart as by God as his possession. Do you live like that? Does your church look different from the other local social club, the community center, or whatever in your area where you live? If it doesn't, then your church hasn't really grasped 1 Corinthians. I think this is an incredibly important book. In the 12 years that I've been pastor since we started this church, I've preached through 1 Corinthians twice. I mean, I could do it again, especially since it's an international church and we have people going in and out all the time. It's only one person that's in our church that was with us at the beginning. She's my wife. She was there, but then there's another who joined us a month later, you know, or a few days. Works. But anyway, that's as I see it, the basic idea of 1 Corinthians. It kind of changes our view, perhaps, our very idealistic view of what the early church was like. Sometimes I have people tell me, our church is a New Testament church. You ever have people say that to you? We want our church to be like the New Testament. And so I say, well, which church in the New Testament is your church like? Corinth? Is it like Ephesus, lost its first love? Is it like Laodicea that was lukewarm? Which one is your church like? And they kind of look at me like, I shouldn't have said that to you. And I said, yeah, you shouldn't have. Because the reality is, people were really, really struggling in the first century. Did they go to the worship at the catacombs? They did, at Rome, when their lives were in danger. But even at Rome, we'll get to 2 Timothy later, Paul's last letter. And he says, everybody has deserted me. Okay, is that how your church wants to be a New Testament church? Everybody deserts the leader? Except he does say, only Luke's with me. Okay, we got a doctor. There we go. All the full-timers have left and fallen away, but the doctor's there. Okay, that's how our church is like the first century church. We know even up to the AD 203, Perpetua, a godly woman was commanded to just take a little bit, just to take a little bit of incense and just throw it on the fire in front of Artemis, the goddess Artemis. But for her to take that little bit of, you know, that mixture and just toss it on the fire would have saved her life. But it would have totally damaged her testimony. She would have been able to live, but live in shame. She refused to do it. And I say this because we have many courageous examples of women, not just men, who are willing to give their lives for the Lord Jesus. I thank God that they pass on the faith to us. But we have to be realistic when we ask, well, what was the early church really like? We have to look at 1 Corinthians chapter 7, where the people were saying, well, I'm a Christian, but my spouse is not a Christian, so I'm divorcing my spouse. That sounds like Mormonism today. I mean, the Mormons are doing that. The Mormons, there's a certain, if the spouse doesn't become a Mormon after a while, the leadership just says, divorce your spouse and let's get you married to a Mormon. That's the kind of advice that they were asking of Paul in their letter to Paul. They actually sent a letter to him with a bunch of questions. This church was involved in idolatry. Some of them were going to pagan temples and eating the sacrificial meals at the temples. What do you think might have been in their thinking to do such a thing like that? Help me out. Why would someone go to a pagan celebration? I've gotten invitations to join Buddhist, feasts, something like that, while I've been here. What would be in the minds of someone to do something like that? What would you think they'd be thinking? Help me out.
I think it's two different examples.
Two examples? For a believer to go to a pagan celebration.
Yeah, like because we could come from families that
okay,
so one. We are the only Christian, so it becomes like family outing than a pagan worship.
Yeah.
Compared to the Corinthians, people in Corinthians. That's why I was thinking maybe the example whether it's similar.
Whether it's with your family or not.
Some people go because it's a family thing.
Yeah.
Maybe
yeah.
Not to a Buddhist temple, but let's say, for example, for the past 20 years of my life, I've been doing this, like going to the tombs and all that. But when I become a Christian, when I go, what then is the meaning for me when I go?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it also depends on what you do when you go to the tombs of your grandparents or great grandparents or whatever.
Yes.
Filial piety is biblical.
Yes.
Giving honor to our ancestors is biblical. There we have to separate that.
Yeah,
by the way, don't get the idea that those of us, a few of us here are Westerners, when we go to our family celebrations, everything's really easy. I don't want to speak for my fellow Westerners here, but I know for myself, going and celebrating Christmas with my family members back in the U.S. who don't know Jesus, honestly, it's very difficult. But they feel a need for community. I have a need for community, and I love my family, But to go through a whole Christmas celebration in the last few days and never mention Jesus is, it's like, wow, you guys are missing the main thing here. I find that really, really difficult. Anyway. Yeah.
And then culturally, we say okay, all these things of prosperity and wealth and blessings, And it's actually, I think to Sylvia's point, with my family, when they would say that, of course I did the same thing with a church group and we sang the doxology.
And we did a lohe as a whole student body last week,
yeah,
or 2 weeks ago.
I think they let us in words of, So yeah. I think, do I say, they always say prosper, prosper, right?
Yeah.
That's a Chinese word. Do we say it?
Yeah. Very good, yeah.
I think it's to Sylvia's point, it's family. I would say that I think the Holy Spirit convicts me if it's everything is permissible, but not everything is beneficial.
Very good. There you go, quote in 1 Corinthians. I love lohe because... Well, there's just a lot of honey amidst that all those vegetables, and then when you eat it later, wow, it tastes so sweet, and that's biblical, because Proverbs says, "Eat honey, my son, for it is good." I try to quote that verse every time my wife brings up. She wants me to eat the, you know, muffin without the honey. I go, sweetheart, it's biblical to eat honey. You know, but I try to finish the verse too. But it says, but seek wisdom because wisdom is more profitable. You know, but anyway. Yeah. Well, I'm happy to talk about the one here that you think is the most important. Let me talk about gifts. Their whole perspective on spiritual gifts. God gave me a spiritual gift so I can feel good about me. It's enjoyable to share your spiritual gift, to use your spiritual gift. Don't you think it is? When you use your gift, and I would guess in this class, with 29 of you being counselors, I think there's a lot of encouragers in this class. There's a lot of counselors. There's a lot gifted with the gift of encouragement. Don't you feel encouraged when you encourage other people? When you finish a session with one of your clients and they go, ah, I have a new insight. I think this is going to help me in my marriage or my relationship with my children or whatever it might. You should feel encouraged. But let me ask you this. Is that the reason you should counsel? Is that the reason you should? I mean, some of you look at us professors here, you know, and you think, oh, I could never, like today, I'll teach 6 hours today. A lot of you go, that would just kill me to teach 6 hours. And I say, no, I got to let the students go after the 6 hour because they can't handle anymore. I can handle more, but they can't handle anymore. I mean, the mind can't absorb when the seat's finished, you know. And so when we look at other people and we see their giftedness, 1 Corinthians is telling us, 1 Corinthians 12:7, but the manifestation of the Spirit is given for the common good. That's what the Corinthians misunderstood. And the same thing is true of 1 Corinthians 14. Because, and this is one of the most misquoted verses of the whole book. 1 Corinthians 14, verse 5. No, it's 4. He who speaks in a tongue edifies himself. We have millions of Christians teaching that is the purpose of speaking in tongues. The reason you speak in tongues is to edify yourself. That's what it says. He who speaks in a tongue edifies himself. Do you catch what I'm saying? But the ones who believe that is the purpose of speaking in tongues have not finished the verse. The latter half of the verse says, but he who prophesies edifies the church. In other words, Paul in 1 Corinthians 14:4 is talking about the limitation or one of the negative things about speaking in tongues, because it's only self-edification. So if your purpose of speaking in tongues is to edify yourself, you're missing it, Paul's saying. He's saying the church needs to emphasize prophecy. So anyway, and then the last one, I'll just say, these are all out of order, but is incest. There is and this is the whole sexual revolution of the past 30 to 40 years is, it's just astonishing the things that we do now that were unheard of and illegal in the whole sexual realm. And I'm not just talking about homosexuality, but all kinds of things that are accepted now. Maybe Peter, you can help me, but I heard that there's more people in the UK, heterosexual people living together who are not married than those who are married. Like, is it really true that more people are not married than are married who are living with someone of the opposite sex? Wow. I see it in my own country because retirement benefits are based on whether you are married or not. So many widowers and widows, when they meet someone else after their spouse has passed away, if they marry that person and live together, then their retirement benefits are cut. And so we have immorality going on among those in their 60s, 70s, 80s, 90 years old in my country, because it's the laws favor immorality more than morality. The laws favor living together over being married to someone. And of course it just undercuts the whole morality of society when you have that. Well, these kinds of things were happening in Corinth. Paul could not just let these things go without teaching about it. And so we have this book, this letter, that addresses so many of these same issues that we face today. You know, I could go on and share about many different things about Corinth, but maybe I can just ask you any of your questions you have. We don't have that much time left. Just got about 13 minutes left.
Yeah. Many questions.
So let's start with maybe you give one question, and then we'll give somebody else an opportunity for another question.
Yeah.
A particular chapter, or
just First Corinthians.
As a whole, what's your question, Charmaine?
Maybe the main question would be like tongues. Because you say that tongues is also, it's true that it is better that tongues is interpreted. But at the same time, you put that in your online course that it is not for self-edification.
This is not tongues here, because you don't see any tongue. I'm shifting it. This is meat, whether you should eat meat. But she's talking about tongues, so I'm going to jump up to chapter
and you did mention
12, as first mentioned.
Yeah, mm-hmm. So I think in your online, you did write down that tongues is not for self-edification.
Okay.
We are meaning that as in contrast with trying to explain the passage that there is a limitation, and God is trying to say that the gift should be used to edify the whole body, right? It's not... So that's one thing. Second thing would be...
Okay, so do you want to address that one?
Sure.
What is the purpose of tongues? That's a very, very important question. Tongues is no different from the other spiritual gifts in the sense of its general purpose, and that is that the general purpose of tongues is, like every other gift, to be benefiting other people. So it's not unique that tongues is good for self-edification and the other gifts are good for edifying others. Tongues is like all the other gifts, so that it's the purpose of it is to encourage others. Oh, you see that in the book of Acts. Each of the time, we talked about this when we talked about Acts, each time God gave tongues in the book of Acts, it was a tremendous encouragement to Peter, to John, to the others who were not speaking in tongues, because they could see God's for a person to go and speak in a language that never spoken before, that would be rather encouraging to the person doing it, but also to the others who were able to see it when that's truly a manifestation of the Lord's work in our lives to do that. Okay, I'm giving you basically a definition of tongues.
But tongues in itself, you also mentioned that it is only a language of another country. I
mean, yeah.
Nowadays, it's not really like that, right?
Well, part of the reason why some people believe that speaking in tongues, the nature of it changed in Corinthians as opposed to Acts. It's very clear in Acts that it was, you know, foreign languages known on this earth. What, 16 of them are mentioned in Acts 2, verse 10. But 1 Corinthians 13 says, if I speak with the tongues of men and of angels, but have not love, I'm a noisy gong and a clanging cymbal. Okay, I'm on slide 216 on the second 1 Corinthians PowerPoint. What's the point there? I think it is tongues used to the max without love produces nothing. I am a noisy gong and a clanging cymbal.
Even if I can speak tongues really well, I'm nothing.
Yeah, being like a noisy gong means you're not really in a clanging cymbal. You're making noise, but it's not sensible to people. Even if you could speak in angelic language, it's still going to be nonsensical to other people. You might be real encouraged about doing it. But he's not saying here that speaking in tongues is speaking angelic language. He's just saying in an exaggerated way, suppose instead of speaking in tongues and while I'm speaking in tongues, I'm speaking Arabic or something like that. Let's suppose I can speak in tongues and speak every language in the whole world. Not only that, but I could speak the angelic language. I don't even know what that's called. Presume there's only one, right? If I could do that, but I didn't have love. It's the benefits are not so good.
Tongues can also be seen as if we do use it for self-edification and we mature as a Christian because of it, it does improve the entire church, right? Because the church is made up of Christians, right?
Well, anything that matures a person, anything that matures an individual, I think ultimately is going to help the church, mature the church. But Paul doesn't say anything here about that tongues are actually maturing the individual. The whole idea of 1 Corinthians 14, to jump over to the next chapter, is that prophecy benefits other believers. And because prophecy benefits other believers, whereas tongues does not, prophecy should be emphasized. He says prophecy is understood by others while tongues is understood only by God.
So what does he mean by when he said that when you use the word self-edification, that tongues has an effect of self-edifying person? And why does he use the word?
Self-edification means that you are being encouraged. NLT says in verse 4, a person who speaks in tongues is strengthened personally. So you're... if you're doing something that's encouraging you, that's not a bad thing. I get encouraged by teaching, by exercising my gift of teaching. But if my goal of teaching is that I need to go get encouraged, I'm in trouble. You're in trouble. It's like, oh man, I'm feeling really bad today. I'm just going to go teach some people, or I'm going to go preach the gospel, then I'll feel better. I was like, really? I feel sorry for your audience, you know? Your goal, my goal, for the use of any of our spiritual gifts ought to be for the benefit of other believers. So the other believers, if you are benefited, Galman, I appreciate you saying thank you for the class. Because you're benefiting from the class, I'm encouraged. But that's more of a byproduct. That's more of a result of exercising your gift. It should be. It shouldn't be the goal of using your gift. I hope many of you want to be counselors because you really care for other people. Not because you say, wow, I get so encouraged when I counsel people. I'm glad you get encouraged, but I don't want that to be the goal.
Like, I don't speak in tongues. Mm-hmm. How does it happen? I mean, for those who speak in tongues, how do you get strengthened? Because you don't know what you're speaking, right? I guess I'm just asking a technical question. I don't have the experience myself.
I can't tell you. And I can't tell you, and I can't even say what, here's one assumption that we have, is that every person who thinks he or she is speaking in tongues is actually speaking in tongues. That's one of our assumptions. And what does it mean that something is an assumption? It means it's something that is believed, that's not proven. So, Lloyd, what would you add to that?
Just thinking, just speaking Arabic. So, it's like foreign team with a Jew. If you look at history of the Old Testament,
it was speaking tongues was a foreign thing to the Jews. Isaiah 28:11. Let me jump over here.
They have prophecy. They have prophets. They have the Torah and the Word. And suddenly, in the New Testament, people were speaking in tongues. So do you think that is a deterrent for Jews to come to faith, the Christian faith?
Was speaking in tongues a deterrent to Jews coming to faith?
Yeah.
No. No, I don't think so. It was something. We look in the book of Acts when they were speaking in tongues. Jews were encouraged, and Jews certainly at the day of Pentecost, 3,000 people came to know Christ. Well, I think there's an evangelistic purpose of speaking tongues. Let me read it here. This is slide 265. The purpose of tongues is for unbelievers. The purpose of tongues is for Jews, especially Jews. In the law, it's written, Isaiah 28:11, through men of strange tongues and through the lips of foreigners, I will speak to this people, referring to the Jews. But even they will not listen to me, says the Lord. He's talking about the Assyrian invasion. He's saying, you Jews, I got all my prophets talking to you in Hebrew. You don't listen to them. So I'm going to have the Assyrians come, and they're going to speak Assyrian. And the fact that Assyrian is spoken all over Jerusalem is going to be a sign of my judgment on the nation. You think that, if you're not going to listen to Hebrew, I'm going to have these people speaking Assyrian. Paul takes that verse, he quotes it in 1 Corinthians 14:21, is a quote from Isaiah 28:11. And Paul's application of that is in verse 22. Tongues then are a sign, not for believers, but for unbelievers. Prophecy, however, is for believers, not for unbelievers. So I would say, and hopefully we're still friends after I say this, I would say that 99% of that which is claimed to be tongues today, people believe they're doing something for believers, including themselves as a believer. I would say they're doing something else. Because I'm going to take the scripture's interpretation over this phenomena more than I'm going to take one person, because I know we can be self-deceived. I have a lot of experience of being self-deceived. You know what I'm saying? This is clear, and this is translated correctly. And unfortunately, J.B. Phillips, in the Phillips translation, he looked at that and he goes, there must be something else there. So he inverted it, and he said, tongues are a sign for unbelievers, not for believers. He inverted it. It's like there's no. This is translated correctly here. I can't say whether the person who thinks he or she's speaking tongues is actually speaking tongues. But I can say that the person can certainly be encouraged. Yeah, Peter.
So are you saying that? Norm would be that the tongues are for unbelievers, there would need to be an interpretation.
Yes.
And would the tongues be a language?
Yes.
That is known in some sense.
Yes.
A language.
The tongues would be a language, and it would be for the benefit in the church service of unbelievers who are there. That's what verse 22 is saying. What are they trying to do in the Holy Spirit? Soak?
Yeah.
Okay, I've heard of the filling, but not the soaking in the Spirit. Yeah.
And after that, when you run out of words, yeah, they pray in tongues, and they can pray for pretty long, and they realize actually God
well,
is interceding.
Yeah. A person who's praying and runs out of words and then starts babbling, I don't think is all of a sudden speaking in tongues, because they could just be babbling, right? And they may think they're speaking in tongues, but how would you know whether something is tongues or not? The only way you can know is look at the biblical criteria and compare it to your own experience. That's the only way you can know.
I'm also someone that hasn't really engaged with the passage. Is it possible that it could be a misuse of tongues rather than whether it did or did not happen?
There is a misuse of tongues, and there can be a misuse of any spiritual gift.
But if it's misuse, it doesn't mean it didn't happen. I mean,
Oh, yeah, you can misuse a gift, and...
So is it being misused in these cases rather than... I mean, I don't have any experience on it as well, but I don't know.
This is defining what tongues are supposed to be for. So let me give you what I think tongues is, all right? A biblical definition. I think this is a biblical definition. This is God-given ability. This is not something you conjure up yourself emotionally or whatever. It's a God-given ability to speak divine revelation. Because God himself is speaking through the person speaking tongues. And God give revelation in a foreign language by the speaker, as we see in Acts 2, to unbelieving Jews in their language as a sign. So an unbelieving Jew would say, wow, look at this. This, you know, I speak Swahili. And this person, have you learned Swahili? No, never learned Swahili. You were just praising God in Swahili. I am going to believe in your God. Your God must know Swahili. And the person says, yeah, actually, he knows all the languages. And tongues can be in any language. You want me speaking tongues now in Chinese? No, I don't think you can do that, you know. This is God himself doing it. And we always see it in the context of a group, whether it's in Acts or in Corinthians. And by the way, those are the only two places. All you have is Acts and Corinthians in the New Testament, tongues. So in that sense, it's not a big issue in the New Testament. But 1 Corinthians 14 is quite clear. A gifted interpreter should translate that to edify the church. Because otherwise, the tongues is only for the unbelievers, and it should be. But there's a big question about whether tongues are real languages or whether they actually are for unbelievers and that kind of thing. I think the passage is clear. Now, I don't think that you can actually have a special prayer language. And others will disagree with me on this. But why can't tongues be a special prayer language? Well, because it edifies other people. It's not edifying me. Tongues can't be a special prayer language because it's for unbelievers. And we don't have any evidence that God's giving unbelievers a special prayer language. Tongues are not understood. So what's... Paul said, I'd rather speak 5 words in a language I understand than 10,000 words in a tongue. You know, there's a value of understanding here. It can't be a special prayer language because then it would be limited only to some Christians. Whereas God's... I mean, prayer, that's available to all of us. Interpretation is required. The one who is speaking in the tongues in a church should be quiet in the church unless there's an interpreter. Outside the church, it's certainly given as a sign. So anyway, those are several of the issues there relating to tongues, but I've already got you 4 minutes over time. These are great questions, and I'm not trying to shut it down. I'm trying to let you go to lunch. But we'll have next week, and we can talk. We're stretching things out a little bit more. I'd love to talk a little bit more about 1 Corinthians if you want to next week before we jump into 2 Corinthians, because we do have a little more stretchy time here because we have the extra class session. All right? God bless you all. See you next week.